All right, we're live.
Yep, we're live. Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2021, and this is the final stream for tonight, and I'm now here with Gregory Hood. So, you've never been on Millennial before, so welcome.
And no, could you, thanks for having me.
That's fine, and could you introduce yourself for the audience, please?
Well, they might know me by like 20 different names, so it's kind of an interesting question. I write for James Kirkpatrick at VDare.com, Gregory Hood at American Renaissance, and some other publications. Ask of Indiana, I started Youth for Western Civilization a long time ago, which is why we've got the logo there. Basically was involved in the conservative movement for about 15 years or so, and am now working for AMREN and VDare full-time.
Right. Okay. I think I've put your links below, so that should be fine. People will be able to find you. And you wanted to talk about the recent conference, so could you go into that?
Yeah. Well, we just held the American Renaissance Conference a little more than a month ago, and I was struck by, you know, so much of the last year has just been dominated, really just eaten up by COVID, which to me is not what I want people to be talking about. I want to be focusing on immigration. I want to be focusing on political correctness. I want to be focusing on affirmative action and anti-white discrimination. And so it was kind of an interesting test to see whether we were going to have people turn out for this kind of a conference. But they did. Hundreds of people spoke there. By all accounts, it went well. And we didn't have any problems. We've got a system that I think works pretty well for having these events carried out. And it's important that we're able to still do these things to show that, you know, we're not backing down. I think the movement has become a lot more serious, a lot more practical. And that's also why I keep telling people I'm more optimistic now than I was in 2015, 2016. I think you and I have spoken once before, and we were talking about sort of this sense of, I don't know, malaise, I guess, that was sort of in the movement at the time. And I guess I just kind of disagree with that, because as somebody who's been doing this since, I don't know, early 20s, I was always used to being like the only guy who was under like 40 in the room, you know, at any of these meetings. Now I'm habitually one of the older people, if not the oldest, which is a good thing. And nobody's coming into this with any illusions. Nobody thinks this is a computer game. Nobody thinks that some guy is just going to come in and solve all our problems. Everybody understands what's at stake. And everybody understands that this thing has consequences. And anybody who's coming in now is accepting those consequences. And the fact that new people are coming in now should fill us all with great enthusiasm, great optimism. Because frankly, I think, you know, one person coming in now is worth a lot more than people coming in a few years ago. Because frankly, a few years ago, you didn't really know what you were getting in for. I didn't know what I was getting in for. And I had already been doing it for like a decade.
Yeah, I say the same. I mean, I didn't know. I went into this with my eyes closed, you know. I didn't. But I thought my channel wouldn't amount to anything. So,
right. I mean, and that's kind of the funny thing is that they panicked when we were a marginal movement. They kind of put the camera on us and they panicked and tried to tie us to Trump and try to smear him that way. But it backfired because then he ended up winning and everything else. And now we're seeing sort of a different strategy where the conference happened and there was very little media attention because we had a successful event and we had a big crowd and everything was fine. And so they didn't really have their angle. And so they mostly just ignored it. But I think that's fine too. I mean, frankly, I've been of the opinion a long time that the revolution won't be televised and it won't be on the internet. It's people organizing in their own lives, IRL. And that's where the most exciting stuff is happening right now. And that's where you have the biggest growth. And that's something that the journalists can't really cover because what can they say? Like well-adjusted people are coming together to build like better lives for themselves and their communities. I mean, they don't want to tell that story.
No, of course not. They want violence and hate, and they want it to implicate the big tech platforms so that they can then, those platforms can then be forced to get rid of us. It's a strategy.
But, and I think that, you know, there's also a role that they have cast for you where they want you to get up and say ridiculous things or they want you to parade around or do whatever. And as long as you just don't do those things, they don't really have much use for you, which is fine with me because I don't have much use for them.
Yeah, and I think that something that happened in 2015, 16, and 17, and I'm guilty of this as well, is that we thought it would be easy because suddenly it seemed easy because of Trump. It was like right. everyone's there's this mania and there's this energy. And also we were doing so well on social media. So we thought it would be easy, but we also thought that ironic humor and a sort of edgy, outrageous humor was a good idea. And in retrospect, that is just so naive because it's been used against us ever since.
Well, what happened, and you saw this especially with the lawsuits that came up with Charlottesville, is you basically had comments being made by people that, as far as I know, were anonymous. Didn't have anything to do with the planning of the event. Apparently there was a Discord server, which, you know, I didn't even have Discord at the time, still don't. And these comments being from third parties were being used in litigation saying like, this is what these people were planning on doing and everything else. And so it's not so much that I think kind of edgy humor or whatever else doesn't have its place, but you basically got to stay in your lane. And if that's what you're doing, stay anonymous, do your thing, maybe send money if you want to chip in that way, but don't kid yourself that you can make a quick switch into mainstream political action because it's not going to work that way. And this also requires us knowing, you know, be honest about where we are now. I mean, I, for example, unless there's just a huge shift in political circumstances, which may happen, someone like me is not going to run for office anytime soon. But I still have a role to play in putting the message out there and affecting people who may seek political power. And more importantly, who are building communities in the here and now, where you're basically going to have the freedom and the ability to survive underneath a system that is, at this point, I think, overtly hostile to us. And that's something else which wasn't true a few years ago. I mean, there were lines that we just didn't think they would cross, and they've crossed them all.
Yeah. And the... We were quite naive about this. I definitely was. It was unthinkable to me that, I mean, Milo got banned from Twitter in, I think, September 2016, just before the NPI conference. So it was already happening even then. The censorship, the deplatforming had started. But even so, I wasn't that worried about it throughout 2017. It didn't. That seemed like a freak occurrence, an anomaly. It was weird. It was a one-off. Nothing really happened in that regard throughout 2017. But then in 2018, it suddenly started. Like people were just disappearing from Twitter, from YouTube,
yeah.
from Facebook, from Instagram, and just one by one, these lights were going out, and that. Honestly, in 2015 and 16, it was just unthinkable to me
that
they would ever do that because it's just right. so obviously censorship.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why, I mean, you hear this term now that our democracy, it's always capital O, capital D, and it's like People's Republic or something like that. It doesn't refer to, oh, here's this regime where you have certain rights and there are certain lines the government can't cross. I mean, at this point, our democracy seems to stand for a particular system, which is extreme anti-white identity politics governed by journalists, essentially. And they get to determine who has access to both the marketplace of ideas and just the general marketplace, being able to buy and sell your stuff. And we all thought that they would at least pretend that this was still a free country. And now they're just being very overt about it. And they're saying, nope, like, we have to manage everything. We have to control the flow of information from a centralized source. We have to make sure that people are being supervised with the discussions they have. And what's interesting is the more they drive people off the internet, the farther they feel like they have to go because new things keep cropping up and they have to keep controlling more and more and more. And so I think they've set themselves up in a situation where they can't possibly succeed because at this point, anything that is remotely free speech automatically comes to our side. I mean, it has been defined as us against the regime, and everybody who is talking about us in a negative way, you can just assume is a censor, is some sort of paid off person underneath the system, is essentially just a mouthpiece for a corrupt system. And Leftists don't like thinking of themselves as the system. I mean, even when they control political power, they still pretend they're the rebels. But like, no, like they are the system. They are the corporate media. They are the regime journalists. And we're the ones who, frankly, they need to settle with. We're the ones who have demands for justice and demands, I would even go so far as to say, for reparations and things like that, that need to be settled with.
And the other aspect of this is how many things they have to censor. It's not just white identitarianism or white nationalism. It's also it's the LGBT stuff, anything traditional, anything Christian, anything right-wing, anything pro-male, and also anything that's anti-globalism, and now anything
the medical stuff, yeah.
Yeah, anti-COVID and so on. So, and that all gets called hate speech. And so the regime is now in this position where they're, as you say, they're sort of hysterical. They're absolutist. And there is one opinion you're allowed on each, on basically every issue.
Every issue, yeah.
And if you don't have the correct opinion on every issue, you're an enemy.
Yeah, what's kind of interesting about all this is when you see an actor or you see a musician or something like that, like you already know every opinion this person has ever had on anything. And you know what opinion they're ever going to have on anything. I mean, there's nothing interesting about any of these people. And the reason there's nothing interesting is because if they had anything interesting to say, they wouldn't have this platform. I mean, that's sort of the thing is that at this point, if you're watching television, if you're watching a movie, if you're watching any of this stuff, it's just the same narrative over and over and over again. And while most people do go along with the narrative, I think a lot more people also just kind of tune it out. It's just kind of background noise. That's why I'm always kind of amazed by people who get really worked up by whatever the media's moral panic is, because it just seems so foreign to me. Like people getting like really, really fired up about January 6th and the attacks on our democracy and everything else. And it's like, do real people actually talk this way? Because, I mean, out in the real world, I don't think most people care one way or the other. They're more worried about what's happening to the country now. And yeah, the fact that they can't afford stuff and, you know, that the pandemic, which was supposed to be over, has no end in sight. And that going forward, I mean, it looks like we're going to have stagflation just like we did in the 70s.
Yeah, at least. I think there was a guy in my chat, in my Telegram chat a few weeks ago, saying that he'd just had a conversation in a pub, an old English, old fashioned sort of English pub, with some young gay guy in, who was in his 20s, who was just outraged at the idea that anything today was better in the past, and that the version of that we have today could be worse than this young guy had the idea that just that nothing has ever been better than it is now, from morals, culture, style, tradition, conventions, everything. And I think that it's easy for us to underestimate because we're outside all of this.
Right.
We're outside of the mainstream. We don't know just how homogenous it is. But having said that, I also agree with you that more and more people are jumping ship from the mainstream, maybe because of this. They realize that they're increasingly surrounded with, well, the NPC, the drones, who are just unable to conceive of much, really.
Yeah, I realize how arrogant it sounds and dehumanizing to just say, well, these other people aren't really people in some sense. They're NPCs. They lack consciousness. But the thing is, if you're in a media saturated environment, like we weren't meant to live this way. I mean, our brains are essentially being hit with all this information and in these forms that evolution really hasn't prepared us for. And so when you see people just sort of reciting these scripts and everything else, it shouldn't make you hate them or look down on them. If anything, it should make you like feel better about them and more willing to fight for them, because when they say silly things, it's not really their fault. I mean, most people just don't, they're only dependent on the information they can get. And at this point, getting truthful information about anything, forget, you know, dissident politics or whatever else, but just like a simple news event that happened maybe a week ago. I mean, even doing that is almost impossible now. I mean, Google, forget it. It's practically unusable in terms of finding like actual information, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's the fact that Waukesha has just been memory holed already. Mm-hmm. And also I was looking at my, there was something that came up that at the start, about a month ago, there was a Twitter account that was Maxwell trial update.
Yeah, and they banned like that.
It just got banned on Twitter, and it had like, I think, 50 or 100,000 subscribers. That's remarkable. But again, if people aren't going to see this stuff, and you know, an account of that size would people, its tweets would have been shared all over the place, so people would have seen its tweets.
Oh yeah,
and if people don't see it, then you know, they wouldn't know what's going on.
One of the things that's pretty interesting is how the whole country—well, not just this country, but I think like the whole Western world—pretty much, you know, they said, "Oh, Jeffrey Epstein killed himself," and everybody basically said, "Well, that's not true." And there's probably all this weird stuff going on, but we're just not going to look into it. And even leftists will say like, oh yeah, of course he didn't kill himself, but they just kind of, you know, say, oh, he was tied to Trump or whatever else. And so we're in this weird environment now where I think people on all sides at least recognize that there's something deeply wrong with the country and with the system that governs us, but they identify it with their political opponents. And I think their hatred of their political opponents surpasses their willingness to actually live in a good society. I mean, it's like what you said with the guy who was in the pub. I mean, at this point, you look at a picture of an American city from 100 years ago, it looks like something from the future. I mean, like it's clear that we're not just staying in place. We're actually, things are getting worse. We're having problems that we thought we had overcome. I mean, even something as basic as lifespan is declining. And I don't think you can just pin that all on COVID. But the idea that we should do something about it, or the idea that we're going to have a movement that's going to address the root causes of all this, a lot of people would rather go down with the ship than take strong action to reverse it. And I think, you know, the system knows that. I think they basically, they're selling managed decline. And I think most people, if they're given a way to safely exist under managed decline, they'll choose that over a risky strategy to save the country, save the civilization, save their people. But the one thing I think we have going for us is that it's in the nature of the system that it can't stand still. You have to find new categories of thought crime. You have to censor more and more things. Okay, you've marginalized, you know, the alt-right or the dissident right or whatever, but the real problem now is, you know, some Republican in the middle of Nebraska, and we have to have a, you know, week-long news fixation on what this guy said on Facebook 3 years ago. I mean, this hysteria has to be constant. It always has to be amped up. And so when people break away from that, they break away from everything. I mean, even the most deep-seated myths of the regime, I think, are increasingly easy to laugh at and dismiss as absurd, just because to swallow that stuff now, you have to swallow all this other crazy stuff that nobody really believes.
Yeah. I think it does depend on being constantly connected and involved in this frenzy of headlines and snippets and quotations. And once you get away from that, I mean, I haven't used Twitter since about a year and a half ago. And, you know, as a result, I'm disconnected from all of the stuff that goes on Twitter. And it's great. It's a really liberating thing. Yeah.
Getting banned from social media is probably one of the best things you can do for yourself, honestly. I still have Twitter somehow, but I mean, God knows I don't have Facebook or anything like that. And, you know, this is one of the things, is that objects online are smaller than they appear in real life. I mean, most people do not stay plugged in all the time. And those who are plugged in all the time, they're not really paying attention to like weird political battles on the margins. They're paying attention to whatever stupid, you know, celebrity did so-and-so. And even if there's a political controversy, everything has to be tied to the Republican Party and Trump and this figure or that figure, who actually isn't that important to us in terms of being on the dissident right. And so, you know, all the criticism that's kind of used against us, it just kind of washes over. I mean, it just doesn't matter anymore because, you know, they talk about us the same way they talk about, you know, some state rep from New Jersey or Illinois or Florida or whatever. It doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. They've overused these terms to the point where nobody really takes them seriously anymore. It's become ridiculous. Mm-hmm.
But you're a white nationalist, just like the former president of the United States was a white nationalist. Like, okay,
exactly.
Fine, whatever.
Exactly. He was deplatformed from everything. So now, what does that mean? What does it mean to be deplatformed if the president of the United States is deplatformed? That is a very strict. That was a Rubicon that I think they probably shouldn't have crossed, actually, for tactical reasons, because it makes deplatforming seem like it's just something that happens to everyone. It's just a normal thing.
Well, certainly the moral position of the United States, with what I've called the Potomac regime, what others call the global American empire, there's no way it can criticize somebody like Vladimir Putin or the government of China or something like that, because the system is essentially the same. They essentially say we have to put out an approved viewpoint on social media. The government works with these big tech companies to get viewpoints they don't like taken down. And then they say, well, this is our democracy, but our democracy is so precious that if we don't carefully control what information people get, they'll vote for the wrong thing. And now, of course, we've already got this thing getting set up. We're seeing sort of they called Trump complaining about the election, you know, the big lie. We're sort of seeing a big lie being set up, not just for 2022, but 2024, where they're saying, oh, the Republicans are already doing this slow motion coup. If it happens, it's because the Democrats let it happen. So, I mean, if he did come back and win in 2024, and I, for one, am not particularly obsessed about Trump, but let's face it, if he wants the nomination, he's going to get it. If he somehow won in 2024, they've already set the groundwork for saying this is all totally illegitimate. I mean, it's pretty interesting if you compare. I mean, I'm old enough, there's some gray in this horrible beard here. I'm old enough to remember, you know, Bush v. Gore. And the election disputes about that. And it was the Democrats then who were talking about, oh, this vote needs to be thrown out because it didn't have the right ID or the signature was wrong and everything else. And I think what you have to be pretty dense not to understand at this point is that it's all just narrative. And the narrative changes regardless of the needs of the moment. So, you know, the idea of even discussing hypocrisy or double standards or principle or any of this stuff, I mean, that's completely irrelevant. I mean, that's all gone. What matters now is essentially who has power, why do they have power, what are the sources of that power, and how do we get from out from under it?
And also, what about the prospect of accumulating power ourselves? Do you think that's something that we should be thinking about, or is it unrealistic at this point?
Well, there are different kinds of power. I mean, I would say that there are certain fields where we actually have an advantage. And breaking down power is a big question, but let's take a couple steps back. In the American political system, one of the things that people are always complaining about is that rural areas are somewhat overrepresented, if you see how it works out. And that's something where we could actually take advantage. If you have people running from rural areas, from right-wing areas, you can build up institutional power that way. If you're talking about power, as I would define it, the kind of power that everybody needs to have is the ability to operate in such a way where you can comfortably raise a family, own land, own your lodgings, and still be able to maintain that even after being blacklisted by the system. So that means being able to get by without social media. That means being able to market whatever you're making without relying on Twitter or Facebook or any of that stuff. Taking for granted that you're not going to be able to use PayPal. Taking for granted you're not going to be able to use such and such a bank. But, you know, there's that Stone Toss cartoon where it's like, you know, build your own website, build your own payment processor, build your own bank. And then it ends, build your own country. And that's more or less what people are doing. I mean, the thing that I think is really good about all this is that all the stuff we should have been doing 5 years ago, we're being forced to do now. And
let me just interject. Yeah, let me just interject, because Richard Spencer, for all his flaws that, you know, people like to make fun of him nowadays and moan about him, but he, before all of this, I think in 2015 or 2014, he
great
gave a speech,
right?
Then I think it was called Facing Our Future as a Minority. And we're talking about in America that white people are going to be swamped by non-whites. And so they should be thinking now in whatever 2014 about how to deal with that. I guess psychologically, but also practically. It was a long time since I watched the speech, so I can't remember now, and I'm sure it's not on YouTube anymore. But the point is that it was there in the discourse then, and then I think that the whole Trump thing sort of made everyone forget that, and there was an optimism that actually we could take back the country, take back DC and so on, the White House. But now there's this, as you say, the movement in America has returned to this much more hard-headed realism that you have to basically create a new country.
Yeah, and you have to do it from the bottom up. And, you know, this is what America was founded on. I mean, if you look at the way the colonists began rethinking their identity, rethinking what it meant to be an American, creating this idea of being an American. I mean, this country was built on secession. This country was built on rebellion. This country was built upon rejecting an existing system, which was headed by, you know, essentially the financial oligarchs of their day. And I think it was Richard II who had The Great Shutting or something like that. This was an essay like 2014, 2015, where you had the first faint stirrings of deplatforming. But again, it was something that they crossed that line very hesitantly. And then once it was crossed, everything started to go. I mean, for a long time, Amazon wouldn't ban any book, books that really have no redeeming value whatsoever. Just how to commit like the worst crimes. I'm not even going to mention them, but they would not deplatform that stuff. But then, you know, fast forward a few months and they're deplat. You can't get a copy of White Identity by Jared Taylor on Amazon. You certainly can't get a copy of anything I've written on there of under the Gregory Hood name, at least. So, I mean, these are things that it's also interesting because it's not that we were unrealistic with Trump. It's that everything depended on him getting in there and staffing the administration with people who will follow his agenda. And they just didn't do it. And I don't think it's some deep state plot. I don't think it's sabotage. At the end of the day, personnel is policy and the failure is at his door. And, you know, he surrounded himself with enemies and then wondered why he kept getting betrayed for the next 4 years. Well, it's like, I mean, there were thousands of people in this country who would have worked for free and would rather be burned alive than talk to a reporter. But he hired all the GOP guys who kept leaking every chance they got.
Yeah, it's quite incredible to think of how incompetent he was, actually, how incompetent he turned out to be. You know, I have a theory that he didn't realize what it was going to be like. That it was.
I completely agree.
He thought it was going to be like being the CEO of a corporation where you basically get your way. Even if you have to reason with a few people, you get your way. I don't think he realized that the president is nowhere near as autonomous as that.
Right. And I mean, this is the classic principal agent problem that you study in grad school for IR or any of these things, government. And this is something that I just don't think he ever thought about. And for so long too, his net worth was tied up in media images. I mean, his name was essentially the source of his wealth because he was licensing it out. And so, you know, for decades, he had essentially mastered the media. And then when the whole system essentially turned on him out of nowhere from his point of view, I don't think he quite knew how to cope with it because the sources of his power were also the same things that were used to destroy him. I mean, they were putting him on TV because they thought everyone would laugh and vote against him. Instead, they made him president. And so, you know, I think the system learned from that and realized that you can't give these people any oxygen. You can't give these people a fair hearing. You have to constantly have this hysteria and moral craziness and panic all the time. But, I mean, I think that in the long term, that may be a more destructive strategy for them. I don't see how the system that we've got now, I mean, it's in some ways it seems stronger than ever, but in other ways it seems like it's on the brink of just utter collapse on every front, economic, military, socially. I mean, I think it was just today some Democrat congresswoman got carjacked or something like that. I mean, that would be considered, I mean, it's not even news. I mean, they're burying that for God's sake. And at this point, it's really, again, to go back to what the person said in the English pub, I mean, it's very hard to look at Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles, and even compare it to 3 years ago and be like, no, we're moving in the right direction here. I mean, our cities are embarrassments.
Yeah, I've said before that, you know, I was in America in November 2016, so 5 years ago. And even then, there were clear signs of decay. And by all accounts, that has actually continued, even under Trump, because the job of rejuvenating America is just so huge that it can't really be done, at least not even by Trump.
Right. And at the end of the day, Trump, I mean, at the end of the day, what did Trump run on in 2020? I mean, he had the Platinum Plan, which was even more racial preferences for blacks. It's not just that he wasn't offering European Americans anything. It's that we can't even count on somebody taking action against affirmative action. Now, this is something that every conservative, in theory, is going to support, is scrapping affirmative action. I mean, this is the great civic nationalism, right? But even if the Republicans come storming back in 2022, does anyone believe that we're going to see a serious attempt towards that? Even common sense things like making English the national language. I mean, poll after poll after poll shows majority support for this, even among Democrats. But they won't do it. But they will go to the mat for very unpopular economic issues. And that's one of the things people who think that we can take the GOP need to keep in mind, is that the GOP is willing to go to the mat on very unpopular economic issues. If they were willing to say anything to stay in power, we would actually be in much better shape. They actually do have principles. It's just their principles are stupid and wrong and destructive.
Yeah, I mean, Pat Buchanan said this 20 years ago, that if the GOP were to just come out as the White Party, the More White People's Party, then it would win every single election, because that's what white America wanted even back then. But it's too late now.
And Peter Brimlow warned everybody exactly what would happen with immigration, with alienation. Now, this was a best-selling book. You can, I don't know if it's still on YouTube with the way they purge things, but you can see Peter Brimlow and Arianna Huffington arguing against, Huffington of all people, arguing against more immigration. You had Barbara Jordan, who was the first non-white woman to be the keynote speaker at a Democratic National Convention. She put forward an immigration proposal, which is far more restrictive than anything Trump was going to do. And Trump didn't do any of those things. I mean, simple things like getting rid of birthright citizenship, for example. And so it's not that we have these ideas. I mean, if you break it down, if you say, like, what is our end goal? And we can talk about, like, what the ultimate dream is. But if you were like, what are some things that you would want to see done now in the existing structure of government that have popular support? Making English the official language, scrapping birthright citizenship, getting rid of affirmative action, maybe restructuring this or that thing. These are all very plausible things, but you could have literally universal Republican government and you're not going to see any action on that. So
it's amazing.
You have to think about that then in terms of, like, okay, well then what are we supposed to do? Because the answer clearly can't be, let's, you know, work ourselves into the ground trying to elect Republicans.
Yeah. Because the GOP will choose defeat over being controversial,
right?
I guess, which is amazing.
And you could argue that Trump had the same problem, in that he wanted to be liked by these people so badly. I mean, you could tell, and he thought that being president of the United States would win him respect, and it still didn't. And I mean, what you really need is you need somebody who doesn't want the respect of these people. In fact, who wants that hatred of these people, because if these people like you, you're doing something wrong. I mean, again, if journalists like you and want to talk to you, that's a very bad sign. That's a sign that you're probably on the wrong path and you're not going to do us much good. I mean, what we want are people who, I think Franklin Roosevelt back then, you know, it was sort of the rich and powerful who were opposing the New Deal. And he said, I welcome their hatred. And that's what I would like to see a president say about the Washington Press Corps.
Oh, absolutely. So do you think that the future for America is balkanization?
I think that there are several potential futures. And I think that one of the things that has really kind of struck me as I've been just reading and studying over the last few years is how so many political developments that we consider inevitable really broke one way or the other on very small factors, particularly military factors. And so if we say, well, America's political development is leading to this or that thing, we should take care because there are a lot of, you know, seemingly small scale things which can really radically change the trajectory. I think Balkanization is one possible future. I think some sort of more centralized civic nationalist, you know, keep America in one piece type regime is possible. It might not be ideal, but it's possible. I think it's also possible that we might get what I would consider to be the worst situation.
Sorry, I laughed there because I thought it would be like make America feasible again.
Yeah,
that
just, yeah.
That occurred to me. That's America, why I laughed.
Yeah. Make America function again. I mean, that would be like probably the best you could do from a reformist angle. I mean, the worst case scenario is that the system continues indefinitely and just keeps sliding in the, you know, the wrong direction and gets worse and worse and worse. And I think the model for that would be, and the other side says this too, is South Africa, where the current ideology of the state is the conquest of what came before it. And so you put people on trial for various crimes, political crimes that you newly invent. Everything has to be put through the mindset of, you know, pushing this ideological line of conquering our past, of defeating, you know, negative emotions and negative ideologies, that, you know, wars that really can have no end. And things get worse in terms of the ability to function, even something as basic as like having enough electrical power, but nobody with real political power seems to care. And certainly the journalists don't care. I mean, if people are starving or the power doesn't work or crime is going through the roof, I mean, what do these people care? What really matters is that somebody like put the wrong flag on an Instagram post 5 years ago and still has an account. Like that'll be an important story. But yeah. You know, like you said, the situation in Wisconsin, I mean, that's already been buried. We'll never hear from it again.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder what will happen with that. There was one story that came out maybe a week or 2 weeks later where he said, Daniel Brooks said that he felt demonized.
Right.
But that was it. And that was the only mention I've seen of the whole thing since it occurred. There's been other stuff, but I'm missing it.
I mean, I'm sure we'll get a bunch of heartwarming stories about, you know, various ministers lining up to forgive the guy and send him stuff. And, you know, maybe he'll go elected to Congress or something from his jailhouse cell, whatever. I mean, at this point, you have to – I'm not telling people to become cynical and jaded, but you have to the kind of pure spirit we need, it almost has to begin with a certain amount of cynicism, because when the media is trying to get you worked up about something, when they're trying to get you morally outraged about something, there has to be that part of you that just says, no, none of this matters. Like this is all a game. I'm not believing anything you're telling me. And even if you really feel this way, it is of no moral significance because you're just feeling this way because you're being told to feel this way. And I think it's only by sort of like penetrating that you can actually see what's really happening in this country and what people should really be getting worked up about in this country. And I think the Wisconsin case is an extraordinary example because on paper, I mean, you have the most sympathetic victims possible. And you have a perpetrator, an alleged perpetrator, who just openly stated, like, no, like, I want to hurt white people. Like, I hate these people. We need to start hitting them. We need to do this. We need to do that. The evidence is all there. And yet, you know, within hours of this happening, they were just lying to our face, being like, nope, this has no moral significance whatsoever. It doesn't matter. The real problem is that, you know, Donald Trump's rhetoric somehow is causing black people to punch Chinese people in New York City. Like, that's what we need to be worried about.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible how things can be repurposed very quickly and very easily by the media to serve the narratives that they want. It's depressing. It is depressing because you realize that this means really nothing is as it's being presented. You can't rely on anything. The media is just, it's a system for lying.
Yeah.
Basically.
But I mean, that's, there are, two ways to take away from that thing, though. One is that it should actually let you think a little bit better about your fellow countrymen who, you know, seem so misguided and so foolish sometimes. But you have to think to yourself, I mean, you're surrounded in this all-encompassing system. You know, what do you expect normal people to do? So, I mean, you should actually not be too hard on them. And the other side of that is that if we have power, I mean, people will come around to believing, I think, normal, healthy things much more quickly than they've been forced to believe all this other stuff. I mean, if victory was impossible, their propaganda would be unnecessary. And I think the fact that they have to go nuts censoring us and everything else, that should be a great sign for hope.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. There are several questions, but I'll get to those in a moment. You said that you don't think COVID is very relevant. Now, I won't. You can talk about this as little as you want. I just want to ask the question. I get the strong impression that in America, it has been less of an existential head fuck than it has been in Europe.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It also depends. It depends where you live here.
Yeah, yeah. You see, the way it's viewed by me and a lot of other people in Britain and Europe is that this, what we've seen over the last 2 years, represents like the anti-white thing is only one component of a much greater paradigm, which is a set of ideas, a new worldview that they're trying to implant. And COVID is the delivery mechanism for that. Right. Now, you could say there's not a direct relationship between the anti-white stuff and COVID, but there is a direct relationship between the anti-white stuff via new worldview, egalitarianism, neo-feudalism, whatever, and right. COVID. So would you say that this is just less relevant to the American situation?
Well, as I said, you know, COVID, depending on where you live in the United States, maybe that'll change this winter, is already over in some areas where you just kind of, I mean, some people get sick, some people don't. Everyone has just sort of said, okay, you know, clearly they can't control this. They can't protect themselves, let alone us. We're just going to go with it. You know, people pop their vitamin D and their zinc and they go about their business, and whether they get vaccinated or not, they're also, you know, a lot of people are just like, look, it's your own choice. At this point, it's pretty clear that it doesn't prevent transmission. I mean, I think I can say that clearly.
Yeah, we're on as Odyssey, far as, don't worry.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, as you put it, I think you're right in that it is the delivery mechanism to something far more sinister. Now, I don't think that COVID itself was planned, but I think the response was planned, and they were sort of just waiting for an opportunity to roll this out, because all these things in terms of tracking medical treatments, in terms of tracking where you live, in terms of currency, in terms of whether you're allowed to trade, in terms of cracking down on crypto and all the sorts of stuff. These are all things which are now being discussed, which would have been seen as nightmarish 2 years ago. But now you have the very same people who used to love to talk about fighting the system and, you know, hacking and all the rest of this stuff. Like, they're the vanguard of this movement now, because I think what COVID really did, along with Black Lives Matter, is it was sort of a new theology for progressives who, you know, are looking at their cubicle jobs and pop entertainment and saying, is this really all I have out of life? And this is giving them, you know, something to live for. I mean, this idea of fighting against an enemy that is killing people because they won't get the vaccine, or racism, which is killing all these people. And you could argue like, well, that doesn't really back up with the facts and everything else. But as we've established, I mean, what facts? Facts don't matter. I mean, if you've got enough media power, you can manufacture a narrative. And then it's just like any theology, it's just a question of whether you believe what you're told to believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, they might have a fantasy of doing something more Fed posty to racists and bigots and whatever. But now they can fight those people just by wearing the mask and just by being self-righteous. So in other words, it's a way for them to be aggressive and crush their enemies peacefully. They don't
without
have to
having to do anything. Right. I mean, yeah. And you see this in the stories that have been written, where somebody who wasn't vaccinated will get COVID and die. And it'll just be like some guy, but they'll make this into international news. You know, some guy who did a protest 2 years ago or something dies of COVID, and, you know, his lack of vaccination is number one in the story. And there are people laughing at him, laughing at the family. They get these like weird things from the family where the family basically has to denounce their dead relative and say like, oh, you know, I wish he had gotten the vaccine, this kind of thing. But then you'll see other stories where somebody who was vaccinated dies, or one of these cases where a young man, say, dies of a heart attack at age 26, and we're not allowed to look into that too much. But these are things that have no moral significance. And obviously, from a race realist point of view, you can see how this works with crime. I mean, the Wisconsin thing, that was an accident. Actually, it was the SUV's fault, if you look at the way they covered it. I mean, it was the car, right? But, you know, some guy who, like, ripped a headscarf off a Muslim after, like, Trump was elected, you know, that's an existential crisis that we have to live with forever, even when we find out, like, a year later that it didn't actually happen. But again, that doesn't matter. I mean, to this day, there are millions of people still walking around thinking that Michael Brown yelled, "Hands up, don't shoot." And they're going to continue to believe that regardless of what you show them.
Yeah.
And you just kind of have to accept that and move on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same in Britain with like Cheddar Man. There are millions of people who still think that that was like certain scientific proof that he had dark skin, but it wasn't. It's infuriating. Anyway, that's a different matter. Okay, so we'll get to the questions now.
Sure.
And then we'll end. We can say some more about the community building. All right. This is from PO Box, a certain number that I won't read out. Greg, your book Waking Up from the American Dream was fantastic. I lend it out to my normie friends. That's good.
That's good.
Appreciate
that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, I think it's useful, very useful to have something that you can show to normie friends, because a lot of our stuff is pretty inaccessible for them.
Esoteric, yeah.
Yeah, esoteric. Let's put it that way. Yeah. And then Jay Keo says, great guest, MW. Check out his stuff as well as Sailor, Kersey, etc. at UNS Review. I don't think, let me just check which URL I shared for you. I think it was, it was your Amren page. I'll look for your UNS page as well.
Well, it's they just republish it there, but UNS, you know, you've got, I guess, more leeway in terms of commenting and things like that. And certainly when they republish the VDare stuff, VDare doesn't have a comment section, UNS does. So people who like to comment will see that stuff there first.
Right. Okay.
I should point out, I'm working on a book now. I appreciate the compliments about the previous books, although I think it's a bit unwarranted because, you know, it was a compilation. It's not quite the same thing as like a book. But that's what I'm working on now. And that's Nationalists Without a Nation. And that's going to be sort of my answer to, okay, well, what do you want and what do you think we should do? It's going to be like this. This is what we need to do.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Okay. I mean, that must be quite a different. Is that the first time that you've written a book per se?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote some longer stuff that accompanied some of the other compilations that have been out there, but this will be the first time where it's a book that's, you know, is advancing a single theme, and all the different chapters are essentially just support for that one single theme, as opposed to kind of self-contained things.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different thing, isn't it?
It's a different thing.
It's interesting because I noticed this with speeches as well. Like if they say you've got 15 minutes, that's a very different thing from if they say you've got 60 minutes.
Right.
And I enjoyed these different challenges. All right. SF asks, do you have any idea what Marcus Epstein is up to now?
I actually don't. I mean, I'm last I heard, he was doing well, but I couldn't tell you what he's doing right now. Obviously, I knew him way back when, went to the same college and everything else. But, you know, professionally, we've been on different tracks for a long time. But I know he's doing well. That's all I know. But I don't know exactly what he's doing.
Okay. Now, here's a comment from Anger at Celtic, who's a very enthusiastic fan of mine, and she gets excited about male viewers, let's say, male guests. And she says, "Dear Woes, I'm very impressed with Mr. Hood. I love Millennial because the conversations are always interesting and thought-provoking, and you have the best-looking male eye candy in the movement. Mr. Hood is hot." There you go.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, but I am married, so I got to I have to politely decline any advances because, you know, my wife would kill me otherwise.
Okay, I'm sorry, Angerad. Bad news there. Okay, and Gadius Maximus asks, in your excellent Amren speech, you seemed to leave the door open for civic nationalism if some conditions are met. Do you think it's in the historic American nation's character to realistically go any further than that?
I think it's important to leave the door open because that's where most people are. And I think in the Anglo-American political tradition, you don't get regime change without it being sort of funneled through a quasi-legitimate institution. So if you look at the English Civil War, the American Revolution, and the War Between the States, you always had these sort of assemblies or quasi-legal institutions saying our traditional rights are being violated, the promises guaranteed by law are being violated. Essentially, we're being denied our rights as Englishmen. I mean, that was what drove the revolution, and that's what drove the English Civil War and arguably the War Between the States too. And so you're not going to get anywhere because we have to, if we just say, look, America's done, even though that's kind of what I said in Waking Up from the American Dream, because most people are going to consider themselves, most white people are going to consider themselves Americans. And they're going to consider that America is something which belongs to them, which they alone created, and it's being taken away from them. And they're right to feel that way. They're absolutely right to feel that way. The challenge is going to be kind of breaking away that population from a system that still claims to speak in the name of America, but it isn't America anymore. I don't take credit for this. I don't even think any single person can take credit for this, but it's been said, you know, leftism basically kills your gods and then wears its skin like a suit and demands that you show like the same reverence to it. I mean, that's what it does to its institutions and everything else. And that's what it's done to America at this point. Jared Taylor at the most recent conference went so far as to say that the Potomac regime is now the single greatest anti-white force in the world today. And it's very hard to argue with that because if you say, look, ultimately, what keeps this system going? You know, it's not just media, it's not just banks, it's not just this, that, and the other thing. At the end of the day, it's American power. And it's a tough thing to get people to break away from the idea of being American and saying we need to basically dismantle American power, but we need to do this to somehow save America. You know, I mean, that seems, it's a subtle thing, but that's the challenge we're faced with. And so that's why I leave the door open to civic nationalism, because we need to say like, look, we're approaching this in good faith and all we want is to be treated the same as any other Americans. But if you're not going to give us that, and I'm quite conscious they're not going to give us that, then we can't even begin to talk about saving America because it's already gone. You've already destroyed it. And, you know, now it's just the looting phase. And I say we get our cut too.
Right. So, I mean, America is currently being dismantled by stealth, surreptitiously. And you're saying it would be better if we actually did this explicitly.
Yeah. And I think that it's sort of like when I first got involved in the conservative movement and you start reading, you know, Burke and all the great conservative intellectuals that they came up with 60 years ago when they started developing this into a canon. Unfortunately, they left out a lot of the better ones, I think. But one of the things that I read was Cato, which was a play that George Washington was particularly attached to. And he staged it during the Winter Valley Forge and everything else. And so at the time, you know, when I first got involved in politics, you always think, well, the Senate was the good guys in the fight with Caesar. And then the older I get, the more I realize, like, no, the Republic was already dead. I mean, you basically had these oligarchs who had no loyalty to the state using the traditional forms of the state to rob the people. And so Caesar wasn't killing the Republic. He was essentially saving what could be saved. The system itself had already failed. And I think that's where people need to get to. It's that if you say like, oh, well, I'm going to save America, or I'm going to save the Constitution, or I'm going to save the Republic. I mean, it's like saying you're going to save the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, it's just like, you're free to believe that, but it really has nothing to do with anything. I mean, it's like, I'm going to save the Papal States. Like, all right, good luck. But, you know, meanwhile, the rest of us have to be focusing on the here and now. And the here and now is that America is, it is dead. And so we have to think, well, what can come out of it? Is there still some sort of American nation that can survive the death of an American regime?
A new America.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very interesting concept. And I think that hopefully it will develop in the coming years. Okay, let's end by talking about the conferences and community building. You said that, and the reason I wanted to come back to this topic is I was at the NPI conference, the famous one, in 2016, the one that is now reviled. And at that time, it seemed like, and the media were there, the journalists were there. There was a whole line of them, as I recall. And it was exciting, but I think it wasn't what, and we thought it was what needed to happen at the time. We thought it was what could happen, and it would work out. But of course, not at all. It was they were just there to gather information, like material to use against us, and also that sort of glamour about it, I think, was probably mistaken, naive. Fun at the time, but naive. So what would you like to see in terms of conferences going forward in America? And do you want there to be more of them, or do you think that AMREN is enough?
No, I want to see more. I mean, of course, VDARE has the castle now, which is being developed so people can host private conferences. And I think that is something I would like to see a lot more groups moving forward. AMREN will obviously continue to hold its yearly conferences, and we might even do more if there's a demand for it, depending on how things go. I think that the thing that we need to kind of get through is that activism is generally a media spectacle, right? I mean, very few people actually see a protest or a banner drop or whatever it is you're doing. And so what you're really trying to do is you're trying to get the media to report on what you're doing. But given that you already know how they're going to cover it, regardless if you pull it off perfectly, you have to ask yourself, is there anything to be gained from doing something this way? And I'm of the opinion that the most effective activism now, the most effective conferences now, and I know Mr. Taylor and probably a lot of others would disagree with me on this, but I think the most effective stuff is the stuff that's happening completely outside the media. It's happening in the shadows. It's happening in the night. It's outside the, you know, the light of the campfire. And that is where you're actually going to see like the new nation be born. Because I really like this idea of COVID as sort of a delivery system for this all-encompassing new form of society that's being forced on us, this kind of radical, deracinated. I think Morgoth's Review put it that way when COVID first started, that this is going to be used to radically deracinate people, where you're basically ripped out of any real community. You spend your life staring through a blue screen. And not only is every experience mediated that way, but it's even mediated like what you're allowed to look at, right? Because now you have sensors telling you what you can and cannot see. The way to get around that is you actually have to start doing things in the real world that you're not doing for media consumption, that you refuse any participation with the system. There are very few people in this world that I care about in terms of like what they think about me. You know, because what an average person thinks about me, first of all, I'm pretty sure they don't. Second, it's just a product of what reporters are telling them. So it could flip 180 degrees a year from now. But what's being built in the real communities that exist now, I care a great deal about what those people think about me. And I also think that that's a more satisfying way to live your life. And that's something you can do right now, because I think I saw a poll not too long ago that said the average person like doesn't have any close friends, which is pretty dramatic condemnation of what our way of life is when you consider how many people they're probably connected to on Facebook and Instagram and everything else, but they don't actually know any of these people. Because, you know, if your whole self-image is just some artificial thing that you're putting up on social networking to shape how people feel about you, that's not a real relationship. I think the kind of conferences and activism that needs to be done are the sort of things that build something in the real world that can, by its very nature, never go up on Facebook or Instagram or anything like that. And this is also why alt tech is so important too, because, you know, even if you've got a smaller audience, I would rather have 50 people listening to me who are willing to do something than 5,000 people who will listen to something as entertainment.
Yes. Yes, indeed. That's a good point. I think a lot of us, including me, got excited in 2016, 17 because the numbers were so big. It was great. It was a sense of progress and achievement. But it wasn't really, because, you know, I got banned from YouTube, and only a fraction of those people followed me over to Odyssey or to Telegram. Now, you can hold that against them, and some people do. They get bitter and twisted about it. But I think it's one of those things where you've really just got to accept this is how people are. And yes, yeah. Some people will watch this stuff as entertainment, but they're not that committed. And they're not even committed enough to follow you to another platform. So let alone to actually do anything IRL. So it's a very low bar of entry to, you know, to just open an account on Odyssey, but most people don't. So that tells you if they're not prepared to do that, they're not going to do anything else either. So it's a sobering thing. It's a sobering revelation of how shallow a lot of people's commitment to this was in the first place.
Now, well,
it's not the end of the world, but it's something to be aware of.
And you know, you shouldn't, again, hindsight 2020, and we could war game every scenario. If this particular incident had gone this way or that way, we'd be in a different place. If President Trump had hired this guy or that guy. But I mean, one of the things that the alt-right did, and I think it is extremely significant, is it forced the system to reveal itself. I mean, at this point, as we began, we know that if we have free speech, we win. We know that if there's a marketplace of ideas, people come to our ideas. And so how's the system responded to that? It's saying, well, we can't have a marketplace of ideas. We have to have social media carefully monitored and censored and everything else. And that gives us the opportunity to say, you know, okay, you can do that. You have power, but then don't ask us to pretend that this is any more legitimate than Russia or China or something like that. In many ways, I would say it's probably less legitimate in terms of the actual amount of support that it has. And in terms of the values that are being preached, I mean, the main difference between the American system and the Chinese system is that the Chinese system objectively preaches better values.
Yeah. Morgoth made that point as well when he was talking about the social credit score.
Right.
That at least the Chinese social credit thing, I forgot what it's called, whatever, social credit, at least it's enforcing good values that are conducive towards a healthy society.
Right. I mean, you get like credit for picking up litter or something like that. Whereas in our system, if you like stage a riot, I mean, you get like $2 billion and you say like, this is our democracy. This is freedom. It's like, well, first of all, none of us are free. And second, like our democracy and what it preaches are very stupid values, which nobody actually wants to live under, especially the people who preach about them most of all. I mean, it's a cheap shot, and it's lazy to even make it, but it still tells you something that, you know, the same people who are telling you about anti-racism and, you know, why we need to get rid of single family zoning and why we need to do this, that, and the other thing for equity, these people would rather be burned alive than have to live amongst their pets.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these other people are just like a blank canvas so they can like enact their own moral drama. They don't actually want to live with these people. So,
no. And it's another version of when in the 60s, you'd get some architect who would design a concrete block hellscape for people to live in, but he would never want to live there.
No, himself. Of course not. I mean, basically, the defining characteristic of American life is you need to make enough money so you can live apart from public institutions, because every single one of those public institutions, it's not just that it's corrupt, it's that it's actively harmful. And so, you know, some people say, well, taxes are the price we pay for civilization. Well, at this point, that's not even true. I mean, it's not like you can even get like a road or something like that. Like America can't build a road. I mean, forget that. Like, there's no infrastructure that's going to result from the billions of dollars that we just spent. Taxes are now basically the price that you pay to a criminal mafia to just make your life worse. And unfortunately, the way you make enough money in this system to live apart from it is by spouting egalitarian things. I mean, every system has hypocrisy in it, but I think our current system is defined by hypocrisy in a way that no other system of the past can possibly compare.
Indeed. Is there anything sort of positive that you'd like to end on? Just because I don't want people to get too depressed. And I think that you're quite unique in that you're forceful and you see things very clearly. And I also think you have a positive vision for things. So would you like to end with that?
Yeah. Yeah. I do think that now is the time for people to be optimistic and dedicated and to have utter certainty in victory. And by victory, I mean a political order that we agree with, that we will control, and that we're going to see in our lifetimes. We have to have absolute 100% faith that this is going to happen. And I think it's not just because belief has a power of its own, but if you just look at the way things are going, the current system is exhausted and it's being propped up with every means available right now. And it still looks pretty weak. And right now, the only thing that is really holding us back is naked repression. That's what they've been reduced to. And they're not trying to convince people anyone anymore because they can't. They don't want to live with the consequences of their own policies. I think America, as sort of this shining city on the hill, has now become more of a cautionary example to the world. And this provides opportunities because you're getting millions and millions and millions of white Americans and whites around the world who understand that our people and our civilization are being sold out, and every possible escape route other than us is being cut off. Like, it's basically, it's us or extinction. And unfortunately, some people are going to choose extinction, but not all of us are. And there are hundreds of millions of us, and I think that our potential is unlimited. And if you look at how much is accomplished with how few people that we have who are like actively doing this full time, I mean, it's incredible. There's no other movement in the world that delivers this kind of returns. And also just look how afraid they are of us. I mean, here you and I are talking on Odyssey or whatever, and yet like the entire system of the most powerful nations on the face of the earth. I mean, if enough people are having these kinds of discussion, all that stuff will crumple away like burning newspaper.
Yeah, that's a good note to end on. I've just realized there is another question from Gus.
Sure.
A comment. And he says, people out there, this is when I was talking about people not coming over to Odyssey and Telegram. And he said, people out there talk about saving the white race, but won't spend a fraction of the cost of a Netflix subscription. Well, that is true. It is, again, it's sobering. But
the way people, people are. And it's sort of like, even when I was doing normie political stuff, you know, they used to always tell you, you got to have a self-addressed stamped envelope when you're sending out direct mail for political contributions. This is just for a Republican candidate. And, you know, like, because if a guy has to put on his own stamp, he's not going to mail in that $20. I mean, and you can say, well, this is ridiculous. And, you know, how are people not willing to follow up with their convictions? It's just the way people are. Politics is the way it is. These rules are not that different depending on what kind of movement you're trying to build. At the end of the day, any movement of any kind is going to be dependent on people who have vision and willpower and are able to suffer the slings and arrows of going through it and not even question about whether they're going to win or not. We have to have that absolute faith. And again, I don't think it's just faith. I think it's my rational judgment. Like, yeah, we're going to win and we're going to see it.
Okay. Gregory Hood, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. I'll be back tomorrow night with, let me see, Computing Forever, Elder, Pale Hominid, and Reactionary Expat, the Franklin, and then finally Semiogog. So that should be a good night. All right. In the meantime, thank you, Gregory, and thank you to those who've watched, and I'll see you later. Bye.
Thanks, guys. Happy Yule.
Okay.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.